Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We are having a fabulous time in London. Also, it's award season, so we're flitting around New York for the James Beard Awards
We're doing that too. But the interesting thing is, for one, few days in the year, London is the center of the culinary universe, which is pretty extraordinary when you think about what the history of British cuisine is like. And I'm especially proud myself of the fact that this city has become much more prominent in world dining scenes. Don't you think so, sweetheart?
I don't know quite how to answer that.
You don't?
I think
okay.
It certainly is a great dining city, as is New York, as is Hong Kong, as is Tokyo, everybody's eating well. And I hope everybody's having as much fun doing it as we are.
We're going to actually
be doing this, this particular episode of On the Menu Radio, with talking first, I think, about the 50 best restaurants in the world, San Pellegrino sponsored, Restaurant Magazine sponsored, and that was fun. We had a great time at that.
It was a kind of a riotous party.
Yeah. I mean, we have to start out by saying that for the second year in a row, there was a major spoiler in that the winners were leaked, which took away some of the drama of the actual event.
Well, curiously enough, it didn't take away the drama for us because we didn't get the leak.
Well, we didn't know, except the man at the end of our row
kept on saying he kept on saying he knew what the winner was. The funny part about it is he didn't get a very good leak because he didn't even know what number 3, 4, and 5 were going to be. So he wasn't that well informed.
Anyhow, I mean, as anticipated, actually, Noma, which rode first place 3 years in a row, was relegated to second place, and the Solar Con Roca from Spain,
Hirona in Spain, yes,
rode to number one.
Our favorite person in the whole culinary universe,
Massimo Bottura, hit his stride at number three, which was, Massimo was really happy.
He was totally on
plan. As was his wife and partner, Laura, who deserves a lot more credit than anybody even gives her, I think.
But they were both absolutely on cloud nine.
Right.
And later in this program, interestingly enough, the restaurant, which was the restaurant and chef, which were most rumored to be number one, a restaurant called DOM in Sao Paulo, we had the opportunity to interview the chef
Alex
owner there.
Atala, and we'll talk to him later on in
and
this
program. And there's another particular reason, aside from the fact that he ranked number 6 in the top 50, that we talked to him, and we'll explain more about that later. But interestingly, at the beginning of the program, we're going to get an American reaction. In fact, two American reactions to the top 50
can
awards.
Can I say, by the way, that both of these interviews were conducted at this fabulous champagne party.
Reception, yeah.
It was champagne, and I think there was rum. I didn't have any rum.
It was Veuve Clicquot by the mile. There was Zacapa, I think, rum, which was also terrific.
The wonderful ham.
Yeah,
the jamon.
The Joselito jamon
ibérico. Joselito jamon.
Yeah, with the one with the black feet. That was a highlight of the whole event. But it was interesting to get two quite different points of view that we're going to bring you right now. First of all, Grant Achatz, who's been placed stratospherically among the top 10 for several years. And we got his attitude to what was going to happen to Alinea in the 2013
Awards.
And
he's got Alinea, and he's got Next.
Well, he actually talked about both of those.
Yes.
And then we had our good friend Eric Ripert from La Bernarda expressing a totally different point of view and saying, if I'm in my restaurant is in the top 50 restaurants in the world, I'm thrilled to just be part of that top 50, and I don't care what my position is. So two very different points of view coming up right now. Grant Achatz says he's getting fat. Listeners, this is news, and we had to come all the way to London to record it. Tell us again, Grant, you must be at least 110 pounds.
Well, you know, I'm 160, but whenever somebody says you're filling out, that's a polite way of saying you're getting fat, which, you know, is true, actually.
You must be sitting at tables in your restaurant instead of sitting in the kitchen.
Not quite, but there's that cancer thing that kind of robs you of some weight, and now I'm finally starting to get a little bit of that back, so I guess it's a good thing. I don't know.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, we came halfway across the world to meet you here in London. We're here for the World's 50 Restaurant Awards, and some people are saying we don't want to talk until after we find out what our number is, but you said no, let's do it now. Why did you do that?
Because, well, two reasons. One, it's coming here right now, we're here early, and I felt like this was a better opportunity. And two, while we always value accolades and rankings in various publications or media, at this point for us at Alinea, we're going over that, where we feel like we're so confident in what we're doing, and we realize that 50 Best, while it's very important to the restaurant community, unfortunately, the American restaurants have a disadvantage, frankly, and we are not putting all our eggs in that basket. So, quite frankly, I think that we're going to fall back again this year. So we went from 6 to 7 last year. I think we're going to fall back again this year. I think 11 Madison Park is going to be the best restaurant in America.
Really?
I do. It, in a way, really doesn't matter. So that's why I'm confident in just going, we're here with all our colleagues. It's a great week in London. We get to converse with people that we normally don't get to talk to on a regular basis. So let's just have fun.
No, actually, Rene Redzepi said, everyone knows there is no one best restaurant in the world.
Right. And you know, the word on the street right now is that Dom's going to get a number one this year. And we always make jokes about, and we place bets, quite frankly, at the restaurant. We rank the restaurants, and whoever gets the most accurate 1 through 10 wins $100 or something like that. And, you know, it, after you go 1 through 5, it becomes to be a little bit gray, right? So you can say Noma, you can say Conroca, you can say Dom, you can say Favacon now is like the wild card that everybody thinks is going to crack the top 5. I don't know, but, we line them up, and we have fun with it. And at the end of the day, look, if you're on the 50 best list, you have an amazing restaurant. It's really what it's about.
Well, now, I don't know if Peter had mentioned, you're also, you don't have just Alinea, you also have Next and also Aviary.
Right.
And you were up for James Beard Awards when you get back to the States, so back-to-back awards practically.
Right. And that's kind of the other thing that you have to think about when you're talking about accolades and implications and awards. It's very odd to me that Next didn't get any Michelin stars, because I think it deserves some. And it's also kind of odd to me that it didn't make the top 50 list, quite frankly. But again, with these programs, there's a lot of variables. There's a lot of things colliding together at the same time, that there's politics, there's traffic. Let's be honest. How many voters come through Chicago versus New York City? I think more through...
Or London.
Or London, right?
So, but hello, we're talking about Sweden if we're talking about Nielsen.
Well, when you think about, I've never been to Noma, I've never been to Copenhagen, but again, anything in Europe is a plane ride. Right? But for a voter, for a European voter to visit Chicago, that's an 11-hour flight. If you're in Italy, if you want to go to Copenhagen, it's a couple hours. It's easier. So that in itself dictates the traffic of voters. And if they're journalistically integral, you're not supposed to vote for a restaurant that you haven't visited, right?
I don't believe that happens. I've gone on the record.
I hope it happens, because otherwise, then you might as well just call the whole thing a fake, right? So anyway, there's a lot of variables that come into play. We're just happy to be on the list. We're happy to be able to, you know, talk to Daniel Hume and Will Gadara and Thomas Keller and Daniel Ballude, and we're all friends, and We ate dinner together last night, and we're going to eat tonight. And
where did you eat last night, and where are you eating tonight?
We went to Harvard Arms last night, which was really great. Actually, it was phenomenal. It was the second time I've been there. Yeah, it was phenomenal. Tonight, we're going to play it by ear and see how we feel. But like last year, me and Chef Keller and Chef Balud went to St. John. Had a great meal after the awards. I don't know where we're going tonight.
Let me give you a tip. Here's Peter giving Grand Agus a tip. The most hilarious and one of the most talented chefs in town is Jeremy Lee Quo Vadis on D Street in Soho. And tell him we sent you. And thank you so much for talking to us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Eric Repair is known as the good guy, aren't you? What is the name of your show with Tony Bourdain?
It's called Good and Evil. And actually, at the end of the show, no one is good and no one is evil. We are both good and evil.
Well, you are of the acclaimed Le Bernardin, which I understand has just expanded.
No, we're not expanding really. I mean, we're opening an Aldo Somme wine bar across the street from us.
I love Aldo.
Yeah, we all do, believe me. And we're going to have a private room that will be bigger with a separate kitchen. So, because we have a lot of demands for private events, and that's what we are doing. But it's not really a physical extension of the restaurant itself.
Now, you're here at the San Pellegrino Best 50 Restaurants in the World. And last year you were number...
Last year we were number 19.
And you're expecting to rise?
I'm happy to be on that list. I mean, look, the world is big. It's millions of restaurants. If you make it to the top 50, you're happy to be here.
I agree, absolutely. Rene Redzepi said there is no one best restaurant.
Well, Rene's number one, so he can say that exactly.
Now, yesterday we were at this Cook at Raw launch. Now, you don't go with these people on your knees in mud in funny places.
No, I have not done that. I think you have to be invited to go there, and nobody has invited me, so I haven't done it.
Do you want to be there?
I think the experience will be fun, yes.
Massimo Mottura said that it was probably one of the most wonderful events he's ever been to.
Is what he said? So, I don't know. I'm good sport.
Somebody who shall be nameless said to us, American restaurants don't seem to get a good shake in these awards. Do you have any comment?
Which awards? This one? I think we do pretty well. I mean, yeah, we have Thomas. Thomas last year did very well, I think, with one of his restaurants. Daniel did very well. Daniel Hume did very well. Yeah, no, we're fine.
You're happy. If you're in the top 50, you're a happy man.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to celebrate. I'm celebrating already. So I will be still celebrating.
Well, that's wonderful. We actually heard there was a little bit of a party at your restaurant when you got the third Michelin star.
Yeah, it was a party. When the Michelin came out in the U.S., we were the first ones. I mean, we're the first three-star Michelin with a couple of friends like Thomas and so on. And it was a big deal, and we party hard. Yes, the entire staff went crazy. And we invited the clients because we decided not to serve them anymore. We decided to party with them.
Well, what shall we say? Vive la France and long live the...
The Queen and the USA, obviously, of course.
And we'll be back after the break with another player in the top 50 restaurants and a transition to something else very interesting going on in the world of cooking generally and in London in particular while we were here. So stay with us and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, you know, we've been very busy here in London. Actually, there's been so much going on that the public can buy entry into certain events. I think you should look into it for next year. Chefs from all over the entire world are here for these awards, the San Pellegrino 50 Best. And, I mean, they're from the Far East, from Japan, we have South America, we have Mexican chefs. It is a very, very, very exciting environment. Professional chefs, different cultures, different cuisines. And on top of it all, they've tucked other events into it. One of the events that happened to occur the day before the actual award ceremony was the launch of a book that we were very interested in and did some interviewing before we even came here and then went to the event is the launch of this book called Cook It Raw, which is a sort of a documentation of a series of events.
Well, it's not just a book, it's a movement, I guess.
It is a series of events like workshops in a way, experimentations, which also involves bonding of chefs together. It's called Cook It Raw.
Quite remarkable. And it turns out that one of the chefs who was a long-term participant in Cook It Raw, Alex Atala, has a restaurant called DOM or Dom in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and he was widely tipped potentially to take over as the number one restaurant in the world this year, but in fact slipped a place, I think, or one or two places from four to number six. But it's still obviously right up on the top of his game, and he's one of the leading participants in Cook It Raw. So we had the opportunity to talk to him about what he thought his achievement, the achievement of his restaurant was to cuisine in the country of Brazil, which has, of course, the World Cup and the Olympics in its not too distant future, and also the environment of Cook It Raw and what that meant to him. We were particularly interested in the fact that he said that Cook It Raw allowed him to overcome any fear of failure that he had because he was surrounded by people who would help him, and that was something that he thought was an enormous step forward. So Alex Atala talking about top 50 placements and Cook It Raw right now.
This is actually the first time that we've met Alex Atala, who's the great hope of South American and particularly Brazilian cuisine through his world-famous restaurant, Dom. But I've just heard about you for so long, and when I finally got to listen to you talk, first I read about you in Cook It Raw, in the book,
and
was impressed. And then I heard you expound on that in your presentation at the book launch for Cook It Raw. And now here we are after the awards for the 50 best restaurants in the world. And you placed number
6.
Which, super happy.
Which is, it's not cheap, number 6. But anyhow, talking back about Cook It Raw, there's this whole sense of a society of the camaraderie that is expended through this and it's an event, really, Cook It Raw, but it's an experience of chefs together discovering and creating. And you said the most important thing to you was that you learned to do things cooking-wise, culinary-wise, exploring ingredients and techniques and dishes, because it was one arena where you had no fear. Could you explain that?
Yes, Cook It Raw is amazing experience for us chefs. I mean, the possibility to share same cuisine with the big chefs in the world, the possibility to divide, to learn with them, and also friendship that we made. Each chef lost the fear to fail, because each cook It Raw, after 3 days, looking everything and getting inspiration, getting ingredients, sharing these beautiful moments, each chef must to make one dish for 40 master journalists from all over the world. So this is cooking for journalists is always tense for us chefs. And if that's happening in my restaurant, I became maybe crazy. But in Cook It Raw, no. The feeling between us gave us a strong self-confidence, because we know that we are not alone. We are with another friends who used to cook as well.
Well, this book, I think, is going to have a great impact on chefs in general and on the whole culinary scene. I wanted to ask you also, you obviously didn't come out of nowhere, coming out of Brazil, but did anybody ever hear about restaurants in Brazil before you?
It's an honor for me. I mean, we keep trying to promote in Brazilian ingredients and also Brazilian chefs. We have amazing new generation of chefs who has been trained in Europe and also in my restaurants as well. And we have so nice, so beautiful, so delicious ingredients in there. So for me, it's an honor representing my country, try to give a real value for our culture, our ingredient, our environment, and also for our young chefs.
Now, lately, all the great superfoods of the world have come out of the rainforest. And you did that wonderful video, but doesn't it have an impact on your culture as well as the rainforest itself?
It is. I mean, sometimes to change something takes longer. We can't expect to change the world or Amazonia's scene in a few months. This is the reason why I keep doing. I mean, it takes longer, and we must be proud and very confident in our feelings, in our inspiration, and keep going and be strong and really believe that kitchens, food can be an important support for natural conservation.
Well, now, weren't you excited when San Pellegrino announced that, well, they have the best restaurants in the world, the 50 best. Then they did this past year the best Asian restaurants, and next year they're going to be doing the best Latin America, South American. It has to be an astounding accomplishment for you to raise the profile of the culinary world in South America so high.
It is, and also to Mr. Gaston Acurio, which is a beautiful Peruvian chef as well. Peru is putting lots of efforts on it. They, if Peru didn't made it, maybe Brazil could be together. So I'm really would like to say thank you for Peru from Gaston Acurio, and maybe open the eyes from the Brazilian government to prove our cuisine and give more space for the younger generation, and also for people who produce it. Beautiful ingredients in there.
Yeah, well, you did make a point of this, the wonderful producers you have.
Did it make you especially proud to have another Brazilian restaurant in the top 50 this year?
Yes, of course. I'm a huge fan from Elena Rizzo, from Restaurant Money. We are friends, first of all. And one more Brazilian restaurant on the 50 best. Six restaurants from Latin America on 6 best means a lot for us, for our culture, for our continent.
So Brazil will be known for more than just Pelé.
I hope that Brazilian cuisine could be a beautiful surprise for the whole entire world.
And listeners, you better pay attention, because you're going to be going there for several events, including Olympics and World Cup soccer coming up. And on the menu, we'll somehow figure out a way to go there ahead of you so we can tell you where to go, in addition to Alex Italia's restaurant called D.O.M. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. There's a throbbing music in the background. There's rum and champagne. You must go there.
I'm going to enjoy my night, but I must say that I really enjoy it. Sit with you and stay talking for you guys. Thank you so much.
Okay, we're going to take a break. And right after the break, we're going to listen to an interview with Alessandro Porcelli, who was the, if you like, the conceiver, the inventor, the developer of Cook-A-Raw, who had a great deal more to say on this very interesting subject.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and here's Alessandro.
There is a very interesting phenomenon in this world called Cook-A-Raw, which is a bit more complex than it sounds. We're going to be talking to Alessandro Porcelli, who is the founder of Cook-A-Raw. And Alessandro, I might say that reading about your background, I can see what a complex event this was going to end up being just because of how your life had run its course. Tell us a little bit about your background. Born in Italy, your travels, how about their basketball career?
I have a kind of a multifarious kind of a background. I was brought up in Trieste, which is on the northeast.
Yeah, well, like Lydia Bastianich.
Yes, that's correct. Right. That's correct. So I was brought up there as a wild kid. Basically, from my mother's side, my mother, she was brought up in an upper-class Austro-Hungarian environment. Grandmother, she was from Budapest and from Vienna. And from her father's side, they were from the Dalmatian island. My father was born in Kerch on the Azov Sea in Russia, from a southern Italian father. And a mother had a mixed blood of, we also have some Mongolian blood in us.
Our nephew married a Mongolian 2 years ago, and so I know about that culture. Very interesting mixture.
We were in Trieste, and we had bolito misto at a restaurant that was probably there when your parents were living there.
Oh, okay, bolito misto, the Pepis Chavo. Where did you have it?
It was at Pepis, I think.
Pepis.
Yes.
I think that was the name of the restaurant.
As you can hear, we had lots of different cuisines going on at the same time. My father and mother were professional basketball players. They played for the Italian national team, both of them.
Yeah, how tall were they?
Not very tall, but six foot.
Uh-huh.
But my father, he could jump like more than a kangaroo.
Now, you must be quite tall yourself, though, because in the modern
I'm
year you
six,
have to be.
No, I'm not six, but we had the gift of being extremely quick. So my mother, she actually also was the champion of 110 hurdles in Italy.
And you're like all the European basketball players. You can shoot the lights out, right?
I love that. I love to dribble and pass the ball to the guys. For me, it was everything. You know, it was my bread and butter. It was my girlfriend's cool, everything. I played basketball when it was snow, when it was foggy, when it rained. I loved that. I played until I was 18. That's what I did. Eight hours a day.
But you also played professionally too.
I played professionally for a year. That was the reason why I went to Australia. Went to have a look, but also I was extremely restless. I still remember the time when we had a serious talk with my mother because they were kind of worried about me being kicked out of school and being restless. So she asked me, like, what real concern? What you want to do when you're growing up? And I said, but it's very simple. I just want to travel, learn cultures and languages. And this is exactly what I end up doing.
But you've done, shall we say, a wide variety of different things in addition to playing basketball and being involved with food.
When I went to Australia, let me just one step back. After Australia, I went back to Italy, and I enrolled myself at a university. I did anthropology in Rome while my girlfriend, she was still studying cinematography. But again, the chemistry there didn't work with the educational system. We just weren't made for each other. Decided to quit, and at that year, at the Cordon Bleu Culinary School opened. It was in Via Marche, I still remember, in one Michelin star restaurant called Georges, a parallel of Via Veneto. So I enrolled there, and it was just as well my father could afford to pay, because it was basically just myself, the two daughters of the Prime Minister of Costa Rica, and the wife of a very wealthy barrister in Rome. So I was really pampered by this wonderful lady. This lady used to cook for the Pope once a month at that time. Mm. So she had such a gentle and great touch. And she just brought up all what I experienced when I was a kid, because, you know, we had a dairy, you know yourself, when you have a dairy every day, you take it for granted. So all these soups that my mother and grandmother were making, or split chicken soup, and all this bolito misto, like you mentioned before, going to my Russian grandmother, all this aspic, this very heavily gelled. So for me, it was there, and only later I realized how lucky we were. Also, in those years, what was very important and gave me a strong sense of community was that where we grew up, we had right in front of our apartment a 2 acres public garden where at least between 20 and 30 kids shared games and dreams from childhood till manhood. And that really gave me a strong sense of community that was blended and mixed with a strong sense of culture, especially regarding food, a strong discipline. When you play basketball, you have to be disciplined. So all that was the base for me to kind of walk and discover the world and gather a lot of experiences. And this was basically, Cookie Trough for me is a sum of all those experiences and all those. I follow my dreams, basically. This is what I did. I follow my dreams.
Well, you did a whole variety of things that we can't even get into, including driving
photography
across Canada.
Basically, I stayed 2 years in Australia, and after I spent 4 months on the Pacific Islands between Fiji and Hawaii, I landed in...
I did that too. I did that too. Did you ever go to Tonga?
Oh, that sounds very, very nice.
Yeah, and you and I have one other thing in common. My first car was a used Pontiac.
Okay.
It looked a little like what you had in the photo in the book.
That was crazy. It was 11,000 miles we drove through Canada. Yeah, going up to the Rockies, to Yosemite National Park and Lake Louise. I gotta still smell the air in there. It's so beautiful. And after all the plain of Saskatchewan and arriving in Nova Scotia, eating lobster with before they close our credit cards. Arriving in Toronto in a very foggy and miserable day with $5 in our pockets. Those were great times.
Yeah, definitely. I understand those times. We are a few things in common here, but I did not end up as you did at NOMA in Copenhagen. And that to you was a turning point, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was definitely. And it was also, I could see that all to make use of all those experiences, basically, because after Canada, I lived 6 years in Dublin. That's when I started to work as a photographer also. I had a restaurant, and I worked as a photographer, and after that, I spent 4 years in Madrid, and I worked a little bit in the marketing with Fiat, and I still did some photography, and after 4 years of very unorganized life, I want to go to an organized country, so I decided to go to pack my bag and go to Denmark. This was 13 years ago.
And it was time to the rise of new Nordic cuisine, wasn't it?
Yes. It was in 2003, they opened NOMA, and happened to go there like 6 months after opening, and it was by pure coincidence, because at the time I was actually collaborating, writing some food and travel story for a magazine, a gastronomy magazine in the north of Italy. And they asked me, I did a story on Spain, and I said, well, what about if I write a story about this new Nordic cuisine of the, it sounds very, very interesting. And then my wife called us, she got an appointment, and I met Renee, and the chemistry there between the two of us was clear from the beginning. It clicked in. It wasn't like the educational system in Italy. And we basically offered me, we went for a trip in Italy. We went together to eat Le Calandre, the three Michelin star outside Padua.
We love those guys.
Yeah. Fantastic. It was like a really mind-boggling experience.
And the mother, don't forget, got the first star.
Yes, yes. Yes, that's, and in that, it's in the right in the middle of nowhere.
I know.
Very unsexy industrial area, but, those guys is really so strong.
The wonderful thing I thought about Calandra, and I'm sure you saw the same thing, is that Alejandro had his hand on every dish.
Yes.
He was in the kitchen, and you could see into the kitchen that he was the one who was actually preparing most of the food.
Well, I don't know if it's true still, but I don't know. But anyhow, I think that the reason I believe that Cook It Raw is some of all your experiences and your, it's almost genetically expected from you to come up with this concept. But what really clinched it was when you told me that you woke up from a nap and it was already in your...
It was incredible. Yeah, so after collaborating with Renee for a couple of years and NOMA, I opened my own company, and I wanted to bring a tourist and discover the bounty and the beauty of the land. I wanted to create this urban-rural experience where they could go and experience the countryside, talk to the biodynamic farmers and learn how to make their own beers, and after see where all the faces behind the cultivation of all these incredible produces, and after bring them into town and discover how all these produces were manipulated in very different ways.
At the same time, you were getting a little fed up with the usual food and wine festivals that you trotted around to, all of you.
Yeah, I was gathering a lot of experiences. In 2007, I organized for NOMA together with Renee Looking North, where we presented the vast array of all beautiful raw materials that René was working with at the time, to Wiley Dufresne, Massimo Bottura, it was Alan Passard, Fulvio Pierangelini, all these guys, they came there, and we did this event where we presented to them and to the journalists, because we were make fun of every time when we start to go to all these food conferences, they were saying, yeah, but what do you have really in Denmark? It's all frozen peas and frozen food. So we want to prove them wrong, and we did it, and after all also, in the same year, I organized kind of a tour of René in Mexico, so he could inspire the youngster. We went to visit to Gastronomical University, and that was the year when actually I stopped working at Noma and wanted to open to go on my own. And I started, basically, it was a bit too early to organize this wonderful gastronomical tour of Denmark, and I ended up being a consultant for the government. In there, I worked for Copenhagen Cooking, this food festival. I did two huge events where I brought first event, I want to demystify, bring down to high contact level high-end gastronomy. And I invited 17 of the most prominent chefs in Denmark, amongst them, of course, René, all the others, to get in contact with the public. So I asked them to do a small food sample, and 3,000 people stormed in that day. So it was in 2008 where really things were start really bubbling for Copenhagen. To go back to your question, in 2009, it was coming up at the COP15, the UN Climate Summit. So at that time, I was working for the government. It was a brand in Denmark, a department of the Ministry of Economic and Business Affairs, and they were kind of desperate for some good PR after the major blow-up they had with this Mohammed drawing the Union Post. And so they wanted to say, listen, let's try to find a good idea that was linking environment mental issues with food. So this when I start to really start to think. I already had experiences in organizing food events, but I wanted to find something catchy. And that's
this is
the day.
You have each one of these. You have four in this book, which is titled Cook It Raw. And then there's one that you haven't included. It happened afterwards, the one in Poland, right? Right. But basically, these conferences were scheduled around, first of all, a question, a really significant question. And then chefs that were known for creativity. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's how, you know, about when I went for a nap and I woke up and I had the clear. It was cook it raw, cook it clean. And raw, again, to go back to what you're saying, the question is, raw as a way at the time was to kind of a reflection, a meditation of nature. So what we found exactly about creativity is the putting constraint into chefs, this was came up by talking to them, it kind of enhanced their creativity. And also fear apparently enhanced their creativity. Both Sean Brock and Albert Adrià agree on this. But for me, what was the most interesting aspect of Cook It Raw, apart from the great dishes, these great minds, and to see them how they were creating these dishes, it was this kind of an energy that came, spark from them collaborating, working together, sharing ideas, sharing sweat in the kitchen. So all the egos, they all have big egos, they kind of tamed during those hours when they were preparing the food. It was just extraordinary to see them work. And from that on, a lot of things happened. This, you know, we shaped a lot of friendships. And also, you can see that it's a trend of chefs gathering, getting to. After that, you saw René Redzepi, he started to do his mad symposium. Now you see in Mesoamerica, there is Enrico Vera. He started also his own intimate food conference. So, you know, it wasn't because of Cook It Raw, but Cook It Raw, it happened to be there at the right time when there was this switch in the trend of how gastronomy, the world of gastronomy, basically navigated. It wasn't through this large food conference anymore. It was much more intimate.
Yeah, it's not like people go and sample all these chefs' foods, cooking for each other for the most part, and then some select journalists, right?
Yes.
And so they're aware of what this one's doing and the other one's doing, and they interact. Sometimes you have them collaborating on a single dish. These are all foreign to them, pretty much, though, the locations.
Yes.
To René in Copenhagen. But, I mean, you had them in Lapland.
Yeah.
You had them in dead of winter in Koryo, in Italy, which is freezing. You had them in Japan, which most of them were totally unfamiliar with, except the Japanese chef, right?
Yeah.
And so they have to really think through, what are some of the questions you had them exploring?
Exactly. I mean, for me, the way that I picture Cook It Raw is basically is the urban chef meeting the rural people, presenting with a mass, a combination of unique raw materials, unique techniques on how the artisans work in a specific area, or how they hunt, or what kind of vegetables they have, how they preserve food, how they make salt. What about, like in Koryo, this Rosa di Gorizia, this winter endive that was about to die out because only two producers were cultivating. It's so difficult to cultivate. It's so complicated and costly. And now it's going to be, apparently, after Cookie Throw, it's been recognized by the Ministry of Agriculture in Italy. So bring the highlight, spotlight on those unique areas where there is unique people, and there are so many around the world, and I want them to be known for what they do. Or Josco Sirchi's beautiful vinegar, and the way that was cracking eggs at 6 o'clock in the morning, where we were waking up and spray very gently some of his vinegar on top, and just making people crazy. So this is what Cookie Throw is. It's a platform for learning. It's a platform for sharing. It's a platform where the chef can feel comfortable in failing also. It wasn't always perfect what they produce, but they learn so much from each other, from feeling comfortable in being themselves, you know. In a sense, when they are cooking their own restaurant, they can't really fail because their people pay a lot of money. They're becoming, like rightly so, Anthony Bourdain said, they're becoming kind of slaves of their signature dishes. Cookie Throw allows them to think out of the box, and that is very important. By being together, it's a great stimulus for them to become more creative.
This book really gets to the souls of the chefs themselves and their cuisines in a number of ways. You have them profiled, of course. Who did the photographs? Photography lets you see some of these pictures of people scrambling around, picking up moss in the forest. It's just absolutely incredible, the expressions on their face. Who did the photographs?
We had five different photographers, the first two events. You know, first of all, thank you so much for what you're saying, because together with Fidon, we worked so hard to try to capture and give this sense of intimacy through the book. Also, the form of the book, like a scrapbook, like a lab book, or it gives a kind of a feel of being unfinished, rough, very raw. This is exactly what we want to do, because for me it was one of the most important aspects. So, and photography has been very important. So, Per-Anders Jorgensen is a Swedish photographer. He took both Collio and Copenhagen. And after, we had Eric Refner from Denmark, who took the picture of Lapland. That was together with Anton Saxdorf. It was a local photographer from Finland. And after, we went to Japan. It was Eric Olsen, another Swedish photographer. So all Nordic photographers, basically, until now. Apart from the last event in Poland, which I had my friend Julio Moya, the photographer. We had two photographers also in Poland. It was Anton Saxdorf and Julio Moya from Madrid. So it was very important to capture those moments, and they did a pretty astonishing job.
I love you. You have professional journalists do introductions to the segments, and so you get a feeling of like the settings for all of this. And then you have the chefs describing their dishes, which is always something difficult for a chef to do.
Yeah.
And those are rather amazing statements, don't you think?
I think that this is very important, because it's so much an integral part of the event in itself. You know, when the chef arrive in there, they explore the area. You find, by organizing the event, they spend out 2 months before, even more, sometime, find the right things to show to them. So they explore, they meditate, they curate. It's a nod, basically, to the country where they've been. And it's so inspiring, because they gave really a lot of thought. So it's not just about the dish. It's a nod. And a nod should be told. And I think that's so beautiful, so poetic, that they also think in terms of words, and not just in terms of what kind of raw materials that are going on the dish. So it's a very, very important aspect, and very beautiful also.
Now, how long do the events last for the chefs? Are they 5 days or 10 days? Or?
It varies. But, in Copenhagen, it was just 2 days, and after, I thought it was far too late. And after, it's between 1-5 days to a week. Now in the south, if we are going to do it, if we manage to do it, it would be 10 days.
Now this is heading. This is the American south you're talking about.
Yes.
Great. Well,
are you going to? I knew you were going to do some research there, but you're planning on researching it to be a Cook at Raw event in the southern U.S.
I hope it will happen. You know, we are working with great people at the moment. You know, with Sean John T. Edge is helping with the American Food Day, with Ilya Smetkova, that you know, is also part of our advisory board member of Cookie Throw. So working hard in trying to figure out how to do it. Finance, it's an issue, you know, to find raise the finance to do such a long event. But, you know, we're confident that we will be able to pull it off the ground because the content.
Do the chefs have to pay their own way?
No.
Become invited, right? How do you select these chefs? Recognize every one of them. They're all outstanding chefs. But yes. How do you pick them? There's so many outstanding chefs.
We travel for so many years and attending all these food conferences. I have a sense of being a team player. And together, also, we have a great guy with us, Re Petrini, that this did for a living. He was discovering young talents. And this is since the 90s while he was working for the Gambero Rosso. So between his knowledge in the chef world, chef, and my knowledge in the community world, let's say, or in the teamwork, so together we picked these guys that we thought that they were not just the greatest chefs, but also they had some affinities in their personalities and the way that they thought about the foods, that there was so much authentic in their own ways, and we wanted to see if they were able to work together, and it's been great.
I told you what Massimo Bottura said, it was the greatest change in chef culture that he ever experienced.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's been there from the beginning, and it's hard. It's not a walk in the park. These guys really work.
A lot.
Yeah, but no, I don't notice any women.
Yeah, we had in Poland, we always said we have open doors. We never close any doors to anybody. You know, today I just had a great chat with April here.
April Bloomfield. Oh, she's good. She'd hold.
Talking with a lot of people, you know, men and women, all religion, colors, beautiful, ugly. So I mean, we're not closing doors to anybody. So enough for me. Basically, Cookie Throw is starting now, to be honest with you. And the creation of the book, it was a great way to look back about what we did, and also finding and defining what are the values of Cookie Throw. Now we are so confident. We found some principles upon which we would like to not just to base our communication, our philosophy, but also the way that we move forward. So now we also, these are the subjects that were being tackled by the chefs themselves in the book. We have Ronella Zeppi talking about natural environment. Alberto Adria talking about creativity.
This is a fabulous resource, Alessandro. I should tell people that this book is really an important resource for understanding what is the nature of creativity in the culinary sphere today. I think it's really important, and it's just a beautiful work.
What's the name of the chef at Avoce? Missy Robbins.
Oh.
She's another lady chef
from New York who
would fit in really well.
Yeah.
She's a real down-to-earth type of person, too.
And if you want any journalists, we're available.
We're definitely available.
I'm not sure about Lapland.
Yeah, April Bloomfield just happened to talk to her, and she just happened to meet her, and she's a wonderful lady. Like, I mean, there are so many wonderful ladies, wonderful guys out there, and I hope I could meet them all. Also, now what we'd like to do as for the future in Cookie Throw is also try to talk, create some kind of a network with other groups of chefs, like-minded chefs that are basically do something similar that we are doing. So in a way, we are supporting each other by creating a larger network. This, in fact, in Canada, what's also going to happen. I'm going to sit down with 25 chefs in there, and to have some open discussion during breakfast and see how we can share also ideas and enlarge not just the reach of Cookie Throw, but the reach of chefs. They're really struggling to support not just the restaurant, but also all the environment, all the farmers, the artisans that they're working with. It's something that is extremely, extremely important. But also do it in a fun, innovative way, creative way, like rightly so you mentioned. And this is so important. That's why also Cookie Throw has been such an intimate event, not just for snobbishness, because if you have too many people, you just will lose...
Exactly.
Intensity.
It's the interpersonal aspect of it that I think that these chefs... Yeah,
but you can participate in it for the modest price of buying the book, Cook It Raw.
Exactly, that's what I was going to say.
And if you want more...
The book is... I'm so happy about what you're saying. That book is really is depicting beautifully and perfectly the experience. So this is the way for us to reach out to a larger audience is through the book and through, of course, the article that's been written. But I think we buying the book, you will get like a full experience of what we've been through and how much it means for the chefs, for the participants, and hopefully for the audience who read the book, they will understand and it will plant a little seeds also in their minds and start to be more cautious about what they eat and be more seasonal, be more creative, more collaborative, looking at tradition, but not going back to them and moving forward with them. So there's a lot of nonsense books. It's like a beautiful wine bouquet with all these beautiful scents. So I really, really hope that the people will buy a lot of copies and be extremely inspired by it.
Yeah, it's a handsome book, too. Did just perfectly swell. Anyhow, when can we meet you, Ross? Are you going to things? Are you going to be at the best, at the 50 Best? In London?
We are launching, the official launch will be at the day before the 50 Best on the 28th of April.
Where would that be?
It will be at the Royal Geographical Society in Exhibition Street in London. You can buy tickets, you can buy just the ticket or the ticket with a book. It's very cheap.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to be there between 2 and 4 o'clock. It's going to be John Mulholland, is the editor of The Observer. He's going to moderate. It's going to be Renato Zeppi. The guys, basically, they wrote the book. It's Renato Zeppi, Alberto Dria, Daniel Patterson, and Alex Atala.
Well, hopefully we'll see you there or thereabouts at this event in London. So looking forward to it.
Me too, extremely much so.
And good luck with this wonderful, wonderful book.
Thank you so much for your kindness and for this wonderful conversation.
Our pleasure. Thank you. Grazie mille.
Grazie di tutto.
Well, boy, so much going on this time of the year, and I think we can safely call it our big award season, because almost simultaneously, a week apart, came the James Beard Awards, which are called the Oscars of the Food World, in New York City, at Lincoln Center, at Avery Hall, red carpet and all, black tie, people dressed to kill. All the celebrities turned out, and in fact, some of the same people that were in London then showed up again in Manhattan, and it's a thrilling event. It goes on all year round, the voting and so forth. But in the finals, I have to say that New York pretty much made a clean sweep of everything. The outstanding restaurant in the whole country was Blue Hill at Stone Barns. And that's the best restaurant in the country this year. We had best chef in the country, a tie between New York's David Chang and of the whole Mama Fugo line, and Paul Kahn, who's from Chicago, Blackbird, Avery, a bunch of other, not Avery, Avery's somebody else. But anyhow, then we move on to Magala Coase as restaurateur, outstanding restaurateur from Le Bernardin in New York. Both the best pastry chef and the best service went to Del Posto, also in New York. And I'm trying to think of who else. We have, of course, all the regional chefs.
Well, the one most important one of all, and now probably your most favorite award, long recognition, long overdue, for good old Wally Dufresne at WD50.
Who happens to be one of our most favorite chefs in the whole world. And it's been 10 years in the making for him to get this award. And he's just opened another restaurant also,
yes,
by the way, called Alder. And he's very special. So congratulations, Wiley, finally, at last, best chef New York.
And congratulations, of course, to all the other winners, because there are so many contestants, so many wonderful chefs, so many wonderful restaurants. It's a delight to recognize all of them, and everybody gets a day in the sunshine.
and it's wonderful to see that happen. And
for a full list of the winners, you can go to jamesbeard.org and click on award winners, and get both the chefs and restaurants winners, and also 2 days or the day before that, or 2 days before that, where the print media awards books. Journalists and so forth, and you'd be pleased to make your own checklist of who you want to read, what books and what journalists you'd want to read. Anyhow,
and of course we'll be back with you again, same time, same place next week. Guess see if you can guess which restaurant city we might be reporting on. You'll see next week, same time, same place, if you are right. And in between times,
bye bye.